This is a special message just for alumni members. As a former member of the Scheduling Institute, we want you to be fully prepared for one of the biggest decisions you may face: when and how to sell your practice. In this exclusive episode of the Practice Growth Series, we're reviewing some key factors you need to consider to make informed, strategic decisions. This is something we know you'll find really valuable, so let's jump right in.
From the Practice Growth Institute studios, this is the Practice Growth Series to help keep you focused on what's most important in your business.
Well, what a wild ride we have going on here as we begin to actually approach the end of 2024, which is a little bit crazy. Hard to believe, certainly. So, last month, you know, we kind of began this process of talking about, you know, what's happening in the market and market conditions. And so I want to continue, and this may end up actually being a multiple recordings when it's all said and done. And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, when over the last, I guess, since maybe even since 2018, and, you know, the clients that have come and gone and sold their practice and kept their practice and keep working a plan and kind of like abort the plan and just all the different things that have occurred. And so today, what we want to kind of continue with the process of this, what I'm going to call the art of selling things, right? And it's so interesting. And I want you to think about this. I don't know if you know this term, but there's a term called they call it a 360. And one version of a 360 is where you take a person, and for instance, I've had them done on me, and you would have a let's say several coworkers assess you. You would have several subordinates or someone who works for you assess you. And then you would have someone who is above you assess you. So for instance, like for most of your managers or leaders, they would really benefit from a 360, which is your feedback and then the feedback of the people who work for them and the feedback of their peers, right? And it's a really, I mean, it's a little bit of a brutal process, but what it does, and you know, to get it right, there has to be confidentiality, and it's super helpful because you just see things in a different way. And the idea is that you want to know how they see things, right? You don't want to deny it. So if you think about this, most people go through their whole life and they would never get a 360 view, right? It would be like in your marriage, if the first time you ever consider your spouse's view is in marriage therapy, you know, that's not particularly insightful, right? Or the first time you ever consider your kid's view is in the middle of a crisis, right? So ideally you want to be looking. So if we think about it, so think about a 360, which is a circle. And in particular, what I want you to think about is, so I looked up if you look straight ahead, how much of the 360 do you get, right? So it's a little bit debatable. In other words, the static view just looking forward is between 135 and 180, with obviously those edges of the 180 becoming a little fuzzy, right? So if you don't move your eyes. And so when we talk about selling things, I always find it so fascinating how limited everyone's view is. And so today, you know, we are going to talk a little about, well, if you decide to sell your practice and when you decide to sell your practice, right? This is the hard part. Does it really just get bought, or do you actually execute a sale? And so I think it's best, and I've recorded something on this in the past. I think it's best to talk about examples that are more applicable and more common, and then to study the application moving forward. So, but first think about that. In all matters of life, you only see whatever, you might see 135 degrees out of 360. So, you know, you could look at that, you know, maybe like you really see a quarter of it, maybe a little more, you know, you clearly see 90 maybe at the most, but then that leaves you with three more sections of 90 and those are your blind spots. And so as we think about a subject, I think it is the art of looking at anything and figuring out how to get a 360 view. It's like, it's why the drone camera has become so popular. I mean, it just gives you a view that you can't get from a camera lens on the ground, right? I mean, I remember when Apple phones, you could do my kids would do that where they would take a 360 view and spin around, and it just gives you a bigger perspective. So what I want to try to do with you today is to do that, to try to say, well, wait a minute, let's start with, if we're going to talk about selling something, we've always got to be able to figure out how to get the full view. And, you know, when we think about this, so let's start with some of the basics, okay? And maybe this will be encouraging to you and it'll help you in things in the future. So the very first thing about selling things that people miss is it starts when you buy it, okay? And, you know, I'm amazed. I was house shopping with Annabelle. She got married and they were looking for a house. And so she asked me to go and look at a few houses. And she would take me to these houses and I would say, yeah, you can't buy this house. I said, and then she'd say, well, why? And I said, well, and I would point out a problem that any buyer is going to point out, right? I was like, you just don't want to buy a house with inherent deficiencies, you know, like these power lines, right? The traffic, all right? The neighbor, right? And so if you buy something and your only view, so for instance, let's talk about a good price. So when you think about getting a good price on something, no matter what it is, how much of a 360 view is that really considering? I mean, you almost got to kind of say to yourself, and it is funny, that's the classic, you know, to quote Tim Walz, the knucklehead move, right? Is to look at something with only the view of price. So I don't know, is that a 25% angle? I mean, I don't even think it gives you a 25% angle. I think it's probably less. I mean, it's probably like a 20% view out of 360. But some people, that's the only thing they think about is price, price, price. Well, all of a sudden you're so obsessed with price, you forget that there's these power lines here. And you forget that there's there are massive trees that eventually have to be cut down, or they'll fall on the house, or whatever it is. And so, because you got such a great price, you miss out on the real reason why you buy something, which is appreciation, which is it becoming more valuable while you sleep. So a lot of people, you know, I get that call a lot. Hey, oh, I've got a great deal, you know, and probably less now, but a lot, you know, great deal on a practice, great deal on a practice. And I was like, well, who told you it's a great deal? Oh, it's the guy who's retiring. And, you know, and I have to get people to say, it's not just the price, okay? You could, number one, you could do something else with that money, but number two, you got to widen the view. And so that is the number one rookie mistake. And so think about how many people make that mistake, right? And so, like, for instance, the reason you would buy something is for it to become more valuable, or for its use value to, you know, outpace the price you paid. So again, if you take a person who goes house shopping, the only thing they look at is price. Down the road, they will have to go sell that house, but nobody will want to buy the house because it has these glaring negatives, and they might sell it for what they paid for it, which is actually not a great idea when you add in carrying costs. So having the ability to see that, and remember, here's the other part that's hard about this. When you're shopping, as an example, when you widen the view just a little bit, now again, think about that view, right? So one person walks into a house, all they think about is, hey, I can afford this house. So they look past everything. They say, oh, those trees are fine. Oh, we can get the mold out of the basement. We can repaint. We can do all this, la-di-da-di-da-di-da. I mean, what they're actually doing is they're shrinking the view to make the one thing they like about it become almost like a false, it's like a false statistic, right? So they want to make the price is the driving variable. They take all the negatives and then they do exactly the opposite of what you should do, right? And they get excited about it and look past the negatives. Well, that's a terrible, terrible thing. And if you've ever done this, you are familiar with this. If you own something today that you can't sell, it's probably because you bought something that obviously nobody else was going to buy, but the only reason you bought it was cheap. The price was cheap, and you looked past the negatives when those should have been your primary points of interest, meaning when you go to buy something, you want to buy something, and then you want to make it nicer, right? And you want to have some upside. You want to either get your money back out of it and have enjoyed it, or you want to make a profit. So if you are considering buying anything, you have to be able to put together a case for buying it, improving it, and then knowing why someone else is going to want to buy it at a higher price. So the easiest way for me to get you to think about this is how and where people do this. So for instance, if you look at the three major things that you will have to sell over the course of your life, besides obviously whatever it is you do for a living, I'm going to exclude that one for the sake of this argument. It is normally a car or an automobile. It is a home. And then in your case, it would be a business. So those are kind of the three most expensive things that people acquire during their life. And they're the three that people trade out the most. And so they're the easiest to use. It was funny, I was watching a football game last night, and there was a commercial for this like magic, they didn't call it magic, but it was like an infomercial for this material, this like liquid that you put on a rag and you wipe it on maybe like a plastic piece of a car that has been faded to make it darker or richer. And then they also had one that you could put on the headlights to make that worn out thing go away. So imagine if somebody had a car that had been sitting outside and had been faded, and they simply bought that material and they lacquered it up right before you got there to see the car. I mean, the difference before and after is dramatic. And it's probably worth hundreds and hundreds, maybe $1,000, to just take some time to find that solution and apply it to a faded out black bumper or a black fender or whatever it might be. And so one person releases a car that they haven't taken care of. And I want to talk about that. The concept of stewardship is the concept of taking care of something. So I want to remind you that the reason why you want to be a good steward, I mean, because it follows buying something as the next most important thing. You want to buy something that you know is going to be more valuable, even if it's more expensive than the cheaper thing, because that's where you make all the money. You never make money buying a asset that cannot become more valuable, right? And so thinking about that, so at buying it is the most important piece, but then you look at stewardship, which is taking care of it during your ownership. What that does is that sets up a sale of a higher value. So Let's take a look at this, and you know, this is the reason it's probably going to take me several recordings to go through this is if you jump past some of this basic psychology, it gives you the illusion you have a larger view than you really do, meaning that you think you've looked at everything when you really haven't, right? So it's kind of like, you know, probably an agent doesn't go to your house and the first thing they say is, why did you buy this disastrous house, right? No one's going to want to buy this thing. But sometimes that's true, you know, because you bought a house in a floodplain with a power line next to a nuclear reactor. Now, again, you know, you could say it was all you could afford, but you could also say that was the worst financial decision you've ever made in your life. So we have buying it, and then we have how you take care of it. So the other thing I want to tell you something. If you ever bought anything bad, just get out. Just get out. Sell it, get your money out, and buy something with an upside. I mean, I can't even emphasize that enough. Like, don't hold bad assets. I mean, there's just no point in it at all. And because by the time you pay the taxes and take care of them, they're just a bad idea. They never become more valuable. That's why in office shopping, I'm always like, it's location, 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 right? The office with a great location, great parking, great visibility, even if it costs you $1 million more, is going to pay for itself 10 to 100 times over the course of ownership and resale. So stewardship is the art of taking care of the things you own. So I want to just have you think about this for a second. And I want you to, you know, honestly evaluate everything in your life and ask yourself this question. Are you taking care of everything you own that you've been entrusted with at the appropriate level? In other words, at the level of fiercely protecting and growing for the owner, meaning are you, and I ask you that because here's the deal. If there's something that you're not, you know, I would suggest getting rid of it. And sometimes, you know, in my life, there were things that I was very excited about maintaining and keeping up and stewarding over. And then as I got in different stages of my life, I didn't want to be bothered with it. So I would sell it. And a lot of times I sell things because I just simply don't want to take care of it anymore. And so when you think about selling something, we're saying we want to ideally make a profit. We can't recoup carrying costs, but so we hope to make a profit. We also hope to reduce our expenses, meaning you no longer have to insure it. And then the third piece is that you don't have to take the time or energy to take care of it. And so, you know, again, remember, and everything fits in this, right? So number one, we want to buy right. Number two, we want to steward and take care of things. And again, if you don't do that, so think about the reason why over all the years you've been following my advice, I have always been an advocate of paying loans as fast as humanly possible. Because what that does is that reduces dramatically the total interest expense and allows for the end transaction to be much, much more profitable. I mean, you really can make money if you don't pay too much in interest. It's hard to do otherwise. So when we think about a car, let's think about this. If you call up, you know, if I want, we're going to go through real quick car, home, and get to business because you got to get warmed up on these. You know, you guys are like, you want to go right to the business, but you're forgetting the fundamentals. So for instance, if I picked you up, or let's say you picked me up and we went to a car dealer, here's how a car dealership is designed to go, right? You're going to walk in the car dealership and they're going to say, well, what kind of car are you looking at? And the number one thing they're going to try to do, which of course I refuse to do because I'm a good buyer. I don't test drive cars typically. So, which may sound weird to you, but they'll try to put you in a car and have you test drive it. And the reason is that the most horrendous, and most car salespeople are pretty horrendous. I mean, that system works so well. Like you get in there, you smell the new car, you turn on the radio, you open up the sunroof, whatever it is, and you're like, oh, this feels so good. And so right there, this is why people fall for this, right? So they get in that car, they get all excited. Back in the old days, I mean, which was not that long ago, they used to let you take the car home. I mean, man, and because it was 100% certain that you would buy it. I mean, I have literally had dealers say, take the car home for a night, you know? And it's like, oh, and you know, you take it home, you show it to your wife or your husband, and you know, you're buying that car, right, if you take it home. And so then you come back and then think about this, how weird this is. And then you look at your car and you're like, ah, God, I just want to get rid of this thing. And so they say, oh, we'll buy that from you. You can trade it in. And here's what you need to know every time you trade in a car. You're leaving $1,000 to $5,000 probably on the table, meaning that depending on what the car is, and certainly sometimes more, they make a lot of money because they know you don't want to be bothered selling the car. A lot of people don't even know what the car is worth, so they let the person who is buying or selling them a car tell them what their car is worth. I mean, and so imagine it, you know, and think about all of your car transactions. And, you know, in car dealerships are funny. They're like, what kind of payment would you like to make? I'm like, what do you like? If a car dealer asks me that, I'm like, listen, stop. I don't like making any payments. But they have a system that basically guarantees that they charge top dollar for the car they're going to sell. And, you know, they've crafted a story. Oh, this is the price. We don't make any money on selling new cars. I mean, you know, which of course, that's kind of funny, right? And we believe that. So, oh, the price is the price. But yet we have to drop the price on the car that you're buying from me. And so they make money on both ends. And if you think about the number of times people do this, this is what they do. And they are so happy to have their new car and their new bigger payments, right? It's not very tactical. If we jump to a home, you have the same thing occur. What most people do when they get ready to sell their home is they will contact a real estate agent. And that real estate agent is usually some kind of a friend of the family. So usually it's like a person they know, and maybe it's like, you know, your wife's divorced friend who, after she got divorced and needed to start making a living, became a real estate agent. No offense to anyone, but there's a lot of real estate agents who don't know much about real estate at all. and so they invite them over, they look at the house, and they say, here's what I think we can get you. And you go, okay, sounds good. And I mean, there's a bunch of fundamental problems with this. And like, number one is that if you're a real estate agent and you sell a house, you get, if you are the listing agent and the selling agent, right? It's a 6% commission. And most people don't know to ask for a lower commission, meaning, you know, just say, well, I want to sell it at 5%. And if you think about it, the agent would prefer to price the house to sell. In other words, go back to the 360 view. Please explain to me how a real estate agent can possibly have a 360 view of the situation when their commission is driven, and like, the faster they sell it, the faster they get a commission. And does another $10,000 or $50,000 really dramatically affect their commission the same way it affects your pocketbook? Well, and the answer is no. So they'd rather let it go at a cheaper price. And so if I'm an agent and I say, like if you ever interview an agent and she was like, oh, all my listings sell fast, I can almost guarantee you that they also are listed low. So they're like you're good at listing houses low, right? And so it's just important to, this is the concept. So when we think about selling your business, it's like, basically there is absolutely no way without being intentional that you can get a 360 view. Because think about even the way we view these other transactions, we don't understand it. And so the other piece, and I want you to get this in selling things, is that you have to understand the psychology of the buyer. In other words, see, the car dealer understands your psychology. Test drive a fresh new car with new bells and whistles, get back into your old one, almost be depressed. And I remember, I mean, this happened to me one time on an airplane. I had an airplane and then I loved it. And the guy's like, we're going to bring this plane to you and let you see it. And I walked into that plane and then I walked back into my plane and I literally felt like I was riding around in like a 20-year-old Suburban with, I mean, it just was so dramatic. And of course, what happened? I ended up making the swap. It all worked good in this case. But point being, I mean, it's almost like automatically going to happen, right? It's the same thing. If you decide to go out looking for new houses, it's very easy. But what's important is you need to understand the psychology of the buyer. And what I mean by that is that you want to, so for instance, if we use a home as an example, you know, I've always been able to sell my houses very quickly. And I think it was because I kind of understood the buyer, meaning you got to understand the neighborhood. You got to understand that nobody wants to have the most expensive house in the neighborhood. Nobody really wants to buy the cheapest beat up one. And so if you can go in and you can give a house some really great features that are better than some of the other houses in the area, but keep the price within check, right? And then you have to understand the psychology of who might want to buy something like this. And, you know, when you have like a run-of-the-mill property or a run-of-the-mill practice or a run-of-the-mill car, you don't really ever get premium pricing. But when you understand that, like, for instance, it's a sought-after neighborhood and people are, and it's the timing of the, you know, it's in this good school zone and it's that time of year and this house has features that are perfect for a family, et cetera, you know. So important to understand the psychology of the buyer. And so the same thing is true if you walk into a car dealership. There's real simple psychology. The buyer is going to tease you with a new car, take advantage of you on the trade-in. It's simple. In same sort of thing is true. I was on a call with a client who was interviewing. She said, hey, sit in on this call. And it was a DSO trying to discuss, a telemarketer trying to discuss their process. And it was fascinating to, you know, to kind of listen to how they did it, right? It's an absolute, we're going to talk about how great everything is going to be. You're going to get very excited. And then as we continue to talk, we're going to backtrack on a bunch of things. We're going to backtrack on, you know, it starts out, you're going to get all your money. An hour into the conversation, if you ask enough questions, you're going to find out that you will be generously offered a holdback opportunity. And the next thing you know, you're getting 50% of your cash. And so again, understanding the psychology of the buyer, most people don't take the time to do that. So the next piece in selling anything is the study of the market. So if we use as an example, right? So, and I'm just, it's kind of funny, cars, homes, businesses. All right. So let's talk about all of them. During the pandemic, the used car market was insane. That market has cooled down. Now new cars are picking back up a little bit, right? Okay. The housing market goes insane. Now it's cooling down a little bit. Okay. If you look at selling practices, I mean, I had clients that I guess they would call themselves early adapters. And so for instance, if you look at homes, like there's a guy he advertises all the time. It used to be Ugly Homes, right? I had a guy I knew who flipped houses. So one seller's house is so dilapidated that some other buyer comes in, buys it at a discount because it looks crappy, cuts the grass. There's shows about this all the time. I mean, I can't believe people can't understand this. They put some new grass down. They put some fresh paint down. They put a new door on it. They repaint everything, turn around, put a for sale sign on it, and make $100,000 more than the previous buyer. I mean, think about that. That's insane. But it happens all the time. Happens with a car. People buy a beat up car, clean up the car, relist it for a profit. So, you know, and I know you're you know, and trust me, I'm not going to sit here and think for one second that you've never been on that side of the transaction, meaning that that's the most common side of the transaction. It's not that people buy something strategically, invest in it strategically, take care of it strategically, and then maximize the sale of it, okay? And so as we lead to talking about the business and the 360 view, I mean, it's kind of important. I mean, I could literally, so like, you know, if I watched your last car transaction, if I went to your house and I walked around your house and I looked around at it, I mean, I would know whether you were going to sell the thing for a profit or you were going to have to give it away or if you're going to, right? I mean, because you can just tell. You can tell by the way it has been taken care of. And things not taken care of, sell at a lesser price. And so, again, think of 360, right? And think of all the different ways we can have a blind spot. And so studying the market is timing. And the problem with timing is this, is that so if you looked at early adapters, by the way, okay, so let's say that the last 6 or 7 years have clearly been the most active with people buying practices. So let's ask you the question. If you had sold your practice 5 years ago, do you think you sold at the peak? Well, everybody who sold 5 years ago was convinced that that was the peak, but they never really understood the buyer. Therefore, they couldn't understand the peak. See, what a lot of people don't realize is when you sell your practice to certain, you know, we think that 25 to 35% of all the transactions are private equity transactions. Private equity is no different than a used car salesperson, like in the sense that what they do is they buy the beat up car, fix it up, sell it for a profit. I'm not saying it's the exact same thing, but from a psychology perspective, what do you think they're going to do? Buy an asset at its peak, then strategically try to sell it for less. So what a lot of people don't realize when they go to sell their practices, and this was when I remember years ago, I had a lot of private equity companies look at our company and it was like, okay, we want to buy it. We want to grow it and sell it for more. I'm like, well, wait a minute. What that would be like you saying you want to come buy my house for cheap, paint it, right? Clean it up and then sell it for more. Well, why don't I just do that? And so if it's a car, if it's a home, or if it's a business, that strategy applies to every asset purchase that exists, meaning that there's always a market. And by the way, it's like what we should all do, right? We should buy things that are dilapidated, fix them up and sell them for more. And so when we think, I mean, if you start to look at it that way, you go, you know, it's hard for people to realize that they've allowed their business to become dilapidated or that they have allowed their home to become dilapidated. And that actually somebody sees that, and you don't normally come in and say, oh, this is so exciting. You have been terrible with your, you know, your business. So what we're going to do is we're going to buy it and grow it and then sell it for more. But that's essentially the buyer. That's what that buyer is doing. They're not saying, you know, that's the entire strategy. And so most people don't really understand that. Okay. So if you're studying the market, so the question is, if everybody who sold 5 years ago was convinced that that was the peak, well, was it the peak? No. See, because the psychology of the buyer, so you go, I can only give you $5,000 for the car. That doesn't seem like enough. Okay, I'll give you $5,500. Okay, great. But they know they're going to turn around and sell the car for $7,000. So because they're patient, they make whatever, a couple thousand bucks, $1,500. And you just want out, right? So the other thing you got to remember about timing is that the person who isn't in a hurry in psychology is the one who does better, right? So, you know, for instance, I've got a house I just put on the market and I'm not like, look, here's the deal. I don't need to sell it. I actually kind of don't even, like, I would be okay if it didn't sell. I know my wife would prefer me not to sell it. So, but then you'd say, well, Jay, why do you have it listed? Well, because I understand the psychology, right, of a buyer, and I understand the psychology of a seller. And so I kind of like selling things when I don't really have to sell them, right? So if you came along and you made me an offer and you said, well, I'll give you X, and then you thought you were going to turn around and sell it for a profit, I wouldn't even consider that because I'm aware of that psychology and that's what I'm doing. So why would I let you do it? So it's important that you can step back a little bit and understand that when selling any asset, your ability to see the big picture, if you only are learning this at the point of sale, you're probably toast. In other words, what I'm trying to show you here is that the psychology, the readiness, it happens way earlier, okay? And again, you know, it's just sort of interesting. So if we said, when is the right time to sell a business? Well, if you understand the psychology of the buyer is always going to tell you that now is the time to sell it. Like that's never not been the case. It's like a real estate agent is not going to say to you, hey, you should hang on to your house and you'll be able to sell it in 10 years for $100,000 more. They're always going to tell you now's the time you should do it. Right? Same thing on all these assets. So studying the market is a timing issue. And again, the psychology of the seller, the buyer, and financing changes as we go. A lot of people don't realize that the reason why so much money was put into, it's funny, this happened in the housing market too. Private equity bought houses. And in why they're driving money into businesses is because of that money supply. As that money supply tightens up, so does the selling price. We're seeing way, way more deals where they're holding back. In every conversation with these buyers, particularly the private equity buyers, I mean, it's so scripted. They're all special. So everyone is trying to say they're different, right? I mean, which you can't blame them. And it's not true, but they all say it. And then everyone thinks they have a unique approach, which is also not valid. But as long as the seller just falls for it, it doesn't, you know, it's fine. Kind of like the border's not open. I mean, I don't know. Okay. I'm pretty sure it is, you know, like I'm pretty much not going to fall for that one. Think about that. So if it goes back to how do you get a 360 view of everything? And then how do your biases start to shape up good and bad decisions? And so this is the great challenge. I mean, this is the great challenge about thinking about how and when to sell your practice. So for instance, when we look at thinking about this, right? We've got to look at, so it's like right now, most people don't know, why are they marketing so aggressively? Well, you don't know that because you haven't studied the market. They're marketing aggressively because their same practice growth statistics are not great. So, for instance, most of the groups where they bought 100% or 80% of the practice, the practices are not actually growing. So we know this from sales of our clients. I mean, the client would have 100 new patients a month, be making a certain amount of money, and then 2 years after the sale, their new patients had dropped down to like 40. Well, I can tell you mathematically, there's no way you're making as much money. And it was because what they do is they go in and they try to put their systems that they think are good in place, and they've got to take so much of the money and service the debt that they don't really invest in the practice. And think about it. I mean, okay, so let's say you want to exit. I come along, give you 100% of the money. You stick around for 5 years. You may be like, your energy is not going to be that great. So these are a lot of the problems that they're facing, which is why. So if I'm selling, I'm saying, well, wait a minute. You know, these are things I'm going to want to understand. Most clients that sell, as an example, never bother to ask. Like you'd say, okay, so 50% of my money is in performance money down the road. But okay, can I see 20 examples of financials on practices you bought? And I want to see it 24 months after you purchased it, like where what they were collecting when you purchased them. And then I want to see what they're collecting along the way. See, nobody even bothers to ask these questions because they're only thinking about the money that they're getting. And then again, they're like the person going, oh, I don't even see those power lines. Oh, I don't see that tree is hanging over the house. Oh, I barely smell the mold in the basement, right? This is the great challenge, right, that happens. So I now imagine a person who has, I mean, only falls for the buyer's hooks. You see, you have to remember this as a buyer. I mean, listen, I've been a buyer. If I'm buying something, I'm always going to put my will into the purchase, you know, unless I am. But I know that there are times you don't have price flexibility when there are really good things. You got to pay top dollar. And I've paid top dollar for a lot of stuff, but it also then appreciates at a very, very high level and based on certainly on timing. So think about, you know, when you look at this, so here is my goal for you. Is number one, I want you to understand this concept, okay? So just how we started, a 360. Every possible angle, but you can only look out and see so much at a time. And then when you get like the bright, shiny, seductive item, actually what happens with that static view, which could go as far as 180, it starts shrinking down to a 25% view. And money has a way of doing that. Sometimes like getting a check will cause you just to narrow and narrow and narrow the view. And then what you don't know is what's on the other side of it. So, I mean, so I want you to take the three examples and I want you to, so we're going to continue this, right? So we'll pick up next month kind of diving into the practice area more, but it's really important that you get this warm up, right? So did you buy it right? And so a lot of you, I mean, you bought your practice right. There's no question about it. They're much more expensive today. Okay. Do you want to go buy one, fix it up and sell it? Why not? Right. If you can buy one at a good price, you absolutely should do that. We have tons of clients doing that. That makes a lot of sense. If you know how to run a practice, can you go buy a practice that's in shambles, build it up using what we've taught you and then sell it? And the answer is, of course you could. And what we're noticing is that many potential sellers, and remember this, right? We've got the no box, meaning I don't want to sell it. the maybe box, which is very, very dangerous, and then the all-in yes box. And what you got to remember here is when you're in the no box, you're actually doing what I'm saying, right? So it's funny, last night I was thinking about where I would end up, you know, like over time. And I said to myself, well, I'm going to keep this house. But so the answer is no, it's not for sale. But you know what I'm doing? I'm improving it, right? So like I put a pickleball court in. And why do you put a pickleball court in? Because it's a very sought after asset, right? So it's like, I mean, so when you're in the no box, you need to understand you're still improving it for the day you decide to get in the yes box and sell something that is super, super easy to sell it. Like you just hop over in the yes box and bam, you take care of business. But you want to be careful with the waffling or the confusion about what that is. So again, look at all your stuff. And, you know, so I don't want to be in the no box on selling something and then not take care of it, because that makes the transaction very, very difficult. So what I'm actually going to do, and this is not, is I'm going to hold an event in December, and we're actually going to do this like in the round, meaning that we're going to take this and we're going to pull a full 360 view. Now, I will tell you that the invitations will be going out for this, and somebody may add a recording to the end of this on exactly how you would register for this event. And we'll be doing the first one in December, and then it's an event that over time I will look to perfect and do with clients. And it's going to be the full 360, meaning that we're actually going to take this idea. And, you know, it's funny, I started breaking it down, and it's sort of odd because it almost seemed like it's like, here's a 45 degree view, here's a 40, okay, five, that gets you to 90, another. And when I looked at the topics, everything from, okay, are you financially ready, to the psychology, to the actual agreement, to picking the buyer, you know, to what you're going to do next, that it really does go all the way around. And so my, you know, like I've said many, many times, everyone is going to sell their business at some point. It's kind of like you're going to sell your house at some point. You're going to sell your car at some point. We don't really keep anything forever. And so it's the art of how you do it, right? And sometimes you sell something and you buy something better that appreciates better. Sometimes you buy something smaller with less expenses. And so this is the most important transaction. And, you know, what I want to have those of you, listen, if you're clearly in the no box, and the last recording we talked about all the variables, we talked about age, we talked about, you know, legacy and the different issues. But what we've really got to get you to understand is the full view, and then to find your most susceptible blind spot. And for most people, quite frankly, it's money. It's usually the psychology of something, you know, they get tired or weak or whatever, and then it's money, right? So hopefully this continues to get you thinking about this correctly. And then we will be sending some invites out. And like I said, I'm going to be inviting certain clients, and we're going to take a day and a half and literally go full 360 on the practice. And then I'll come back next month and we'll continue to talk about some of the sections within the practice sale now that we sort of set this up correctly. So, all right, I look forward to seeing some of you in December, and I will talk to you soon. Have a fantastic rest of your day.
Request your invitation now to the 12-hour intensive with Jay Geyer, the number one rated industry expert behind the growth and sale of hundreds of practices. This event will take place on Friday, December 6th and Saturday, December 7th in Atlanta, Georgia. Click the link in your email or visit jgeyerevents.com/alumni. to secure your spot at this exclusive doctor-only event where Jay will uncover strategies no one else is sharing, how to maximize your practice's value, navigate the pressure to sell, and protect what you've built. Whether you're selling soon or in the future, this event will equip you with the knowledge you need to avoid costly mistakes. We're holding 15 seats for the alumni members, so act fast. These seats are first come, first served.